Oh, am I the host?
Oh, there we go. It's gone. We're on.
Look
air.
At that. Okay.
Magic. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're done. We're on.
Perfect. Okay, great. Well, good morning, everyone. It's Friday, June the 11th in 2021, and this is the meeting of the regular meeting of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. I'm Brendan Sharkey, the chair of ACIR. And we have with us Lal Ray, who is our intrepid vice chair. I don't know, Lyle, if you have anything to offer to the group, welcome all.
Nope. Just later on the ACIR studies.
Absolutely. Okay. Hopefully everyone has overcome their sleep deprivation if they've been following the legislative session that just ended a couple of days ago. I know I have not yet, but... hence the rings under my eyes. But it was a lively one, and we'll get to that in a minute. I'm sure that Martin has certainly not recovered yet. So
he's smiling. Hey, that's good.
Yeah, at least he's smiling. Right?
The coffee's keeping me going.
There you go. And my Mocha Joe. Okay, so just as a reminder, this is also a Zoom meeting, which is publicly available. So if you have questions or comments to offer, I'd ask that you use the raise hand function or otherwise wave wildly at your camera to get my attention, and you'll be called upon. And at the end of the meeting, we'll have the opportunity for other non-members of the ACIR to offer comment. And their thoughts. So I appreciate you all being here this morning. So we'll move right to item three. I don't know if there's any other agenda items other than what's on the printed agenda that you have all received. And assuming that there are not, we'll move to item three on the agenda, which is the approval of the draft minutes from May 7th. Bruce, I didn't introduce you as well as our intrepid staff person in support. So good morning to you, Bruce, as well.
Well, good morning. And I'll just mention you're one shy of a quorum right now. So I would skip the agenda and I guess also skip the consideration of the annual report until another member joins.
Right. Okay. Well, actually, it fits nicely because the next we'll skip on the draft minutes, which is item three on the agenda, and move right to item four, which is the legislative session recap. I will steal a little bit of Martin's thunder. I'll otherwise defer to him on other items of interest and concern, but. Just as a quick update, if you remember, our RPIP 2.0 proposal was included in the governor's bill 6448, which did get through the House with some opposition from, and if you remember at the public hearing, there was opposition to other provisions of the bill, most notably regarding maintaining the availability of electronic access to public meetings, which drew some opposition from some members, mostly on the Republican side. Though the bill, the vote in the House was bipartisan, there were 40 votes against. Mostly on the Republican side, and all related to that issue, if I'm not mistaken. It went to the Senate, and despite a lot of effort, it was not called. I will refrain from my what I would otherwise offer as my off-the-record comments on the ineffectiveness of the Senate to control and its agenda and schedule itself properly. But that's just a personal thing since I'm a House guy. But as a result, the bill did not get out of the Senate and therefore has not been approved. And Martin, maybe you can take it from there as to what the future is with regard to the special session.
Sure. Thanks, Brandon. Good morning, everybody. Morning. So as Brandon mentioned, you know, the governor's bill 6448 went through a lot of different processes and wound up being a much larger bill than the budget bill. Number of pages, if you were to go online and look at the last version that was done, it was something like almost 90 pages. A budget bill was only like 60 pages. But you know, we had worked very hard throughout the session, worked with P&D, worked with GAE, CCM cost, municipal attorneys, you know, throughout the thing of, you know, looking at combining a bunch of different things in from GAE and P&D that they wanted to do. So we had one bill that encompassed all of the meeting requirements and such. So thus making it a longer bill. There was not issues per se on the ACIR, you know, piece with the RPIP formulas, and very little, you know, on the outdoor dining piece as the three pieces of the entire bill. Not sure what's going to happen at this point, if this whole thing will get called up in special session. I know there's discussions because we know executive order will be ending regarding meeting requirements, you know, and virtual and everything else. And so that it kind of means that if there's nothing in place, things go back to normal, if you will, by as they're required in statute. So that'll be, you know, changes and everything. So I'm sure there will be continued discussion. I have some meetings, obviously, later today and most likely over the weekend or beginning next week once we kind of hear what stuff's going to be going on with that. So that's kind of a quick little additional information there. We're hearing, you know, special session could be anywhere over the next 2 weeks, which will be budget implementer. Will be the cannabis bill, as well as whatever else they decide that, you know, might get called up that, you know, became dead on 12 o'clock on Wednesday evening.
Thanks, Martin. And I wonder, too, if you could comment on some of the other relevant legislation that did get through this year. Or that was at least being proposed. I know the zoning provision got through the House, but held up in the Senate, if I'm not mistaken. And some of the other things that ACIR was not directly involved in, but maybe may have some interest in. Were there any other updates on that front?
So we actually have, I'm just trying to think which other ones out there. So many things. Obviously we've got, study regarding the there's actually a couple things now that I look back at it. The study for public safety answering points, looking at that, is going, you know, with a task force, which ACIR, I believe, is listed in that, you know, on the task force to be part of that. The COGS have been working, you know, with that as well. Some of that was getting them to switch over because of the work that OPM and the COGS have been doing already on that, that we got it to be the task force. Originally, bill came out, they wanted to make it a mandatory thing to automatically combine. So I know that one is out there. And I apologize, my head's kind of spinning of all the different bills out, which ones did get passed and which ones didn't.
Yeah.
on that. So I know there'll be, you know, full list coming out of everything that way. So I apologize. My mind's kind of,
I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah. My mind's kind of off right now of, you know, which bills got passed, which ones didn't. And we're still kind of reviewing and going through, but you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, wound up getting, you know, that died, if you will, you know, on there. Broadband did get through, on it, GIS, has gotten provisions through on that, although there's got to be some implementer stuff with the GIS put into that, but that's already being negotiated out. So that's good for, you know, municipalities on a whole that way. So, but I'm sure other people may have other particular ones that, you know, we can follow up on. And as we get, you know, the lists of what's everything that has passed and especially affecting municipalities, we can make sure to get that out to everybody.
It was incredibly unfair of me to, on the one hand, sympathize with you for being sleep deprived and then to dump that on you to have to report to the entire group. So I apologize.
No, not a problem.
Marcia, did you have, you had your hand raised?
I do. And thank you, Martin. And I don't want to put you on the spot. I'm just looking for a little clarity and I'm hoping we can do this. And it is not necessarily part of ACIR, but it is a globally a regional initiative, and that is the Community Investment Fund. and the allocation of that funding. And I'm wondering if that goes back to the governor's budget that he presented, where there was roughly 30, 40 municipalities that were labeled distressed municipalities, where there was supposed to be 50% CARES Act funding and 50% bonding. Is that the one that has been ultimately changed, kind of gone through some iterations, and now is what has been passed? Is that the funding that goes into that now?
So thanks, Mayor. So it's kind of interesting because there is pieces there. It's going to find out where that funding is actually going to come from, because with the new tiered pilot pieces in there, some of this all has to still go through the implementer portion of the budget to figure out what's going to happen. Because that $50 million originally was put in before the tiered formula piece was put in, giving the municipalities the extra, funding in that sense. We're not sure if that $50 million is going to come from new money in the budget or if it's going to come from CRF. Some of that still, we're all, and part of the tier formula there has to be modified slightly because the way it got passed, we can't calculate the numbers because we won't actually even have them in time to calculate the numbers. Thus why everyone knows with the pilot formulas we're a year to 2 years behind of the numbers when we're calculating the grants, because we don't get that information, quick enough to do. So, part of that all still has to come from implementer, and the budget's still figuring that out. For, is it going to be that bonding money through, like CRF funds, or is it going to be budget money? And that's something that's still kind of up in the air.
Okay. Good clarity. Thank you. I know that there's a lot in the air.
I'm glad it was clear to you.
In the municipalities, we all want answers right away, and we know that they're really not available, but thank you.
I understand that.
Thanks, Martin, for that. And Marcia, Carl, Amento?
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask a little bit more, because we really didn't touch on RSG. RPIP was important, and glad that made the bill and all that. But RSG, the formula was changed so that we finally rectified a mistake that had been made in the carryover of the bonus money for those COGs who had merged. And I believe that happened for 2 years. If this doesn't go forward by any chance, and please tell me that's not possible, the bill, 6448, would we be reverting back to the existing law, which again would repeat that bonus? And I believe it's also going back to a year. I don't know. This I didn't understand why it is referred to as going back to a particular year, something like 2014, when there was a reduction in the amount from 4.1 million to, 3.4. So this would be a terrible, this is like a quarter of the amount would be reduced. And we had already programmed and passed through our board our program for next year, which of course builds off of the last several years. You'd have to cut like crazy. So could you assure me that this has a good chance of making the special session?
Only if you call your legislators and ask that it be so. Mm-hmm. Right. Seriously, I think the subject of implementers and special sessions, I know from experience, are subject to many vagaries and many political pressure, if you will, from constituents and from those who care about these things. So, if the COGS generally are in line with this, I think it makes perfect sense that you should be calling your delegations, both sides of the aisle, to ensure that, these provisions, and I can get you the citation of the actual, I'm not trying to throw the rest of the governor's bill under the bus, but, there are certain sections of 6448 that deal with the RPIP and the RSG piece. Even if it's just for our purposes, those other sections of that bill can be, if those can be included in an implementer, that'd be great. If it can be, if the whole bill can be incorporated into an implementer or taken up in the whole in the special session, also even better.
That doesn't have to stay as one bill, 6448 with the three major.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, I think that it's really, it's a somewhat delicate point, though, because, there are other provisions of the bill, obviously, that the governor's office and others have proposed. We as ACIR requested that the governor include our ask onto his bill, which they graciously agreed to include. So, that's why I was saying I don't want to be throwing the rest of the governor's initiatives under the bus.
Brendan, I think they're probably more popular, more broadly popular on the outdoor dining and the public meeting. So I was asking to see whether they had to be attached because that would, I think, make it more likely that they'd be taken up.
Well, right. That's the political calculus. You know, if the more popular pieces could be thrown into an implementer, the more controversial pieces are not, then, that would stand a better stead of going forward. But I don't want to be speaking on behalf of ACIR and saying that we don't want the governor's other pieces of this to not go forward. Anyway, but yes, the answer to your question is yes, they can be separated out. Martin and then Margaret.
Sure. And Carl, just to follow up with that, as Brandon has mentioned, is we've already, I've already put a request in that at least the RSG formula piece get put into the implementer. So we have that on the secretary's radar here at OPM. Pulling that piece out of everything for that. But until which time something else is passed, we revert back to current statute for funding levels. I mean, that is what we're required to do. We don't have a choice on that. We have to follow current statutes until something else is adopted. So that's what, unfortunately, we have to follow. We don't have any, provisions to be able to change that.
And Martin, as an ACIR member, are you also including the RPIP request as well in the secretary's radar?
Yeah, sorry, that's on the list as well, just for the formula there. On that, if we pull out and obviously we don't know what the whole bill itself's going to do, but, we have that on the list, for consideration. So we'll see, where that all, comes out.
Yeah, great. Margaret?
Yes, just briefly, thank you for calling on me. I was concerned about when they put up the entire implementer online, I was hoping it would stay there long enough so that I can actually go through it line by line, which I do for the League of Women Voters. So just so I can tell what really happened. I was just wondering whether that will be online, for a while.
I couldn't tell you because I'm not there anymore. So I can just tell you from practice, it is a constantly moving target as to what gets included and jettisoned. This is the infamous conveyor of rats.
I know.
That individuals with a particular peak or a particular interest in a particular subject throw onto that agenda. That's why I was mentioning earlier, I think the pressure of the deadline for budget and implementers is important, because when you open it up to a post-regular session, it becomes a free-for-all for anybody and everybody to start pressuring for their piece to be included in an implementer or taken up as a bill. And it does. It becomes a mess. But the bill itself is typically not finalized until the very last minute. And
yeah, but does it remain up for a while so I can read it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the OLR will do its analysis. Oftentimes, it's after the fact, as to what exactly is included. But sure, I mean, I think it's always going to be available for review.
And you have a quorum now.
Apparently, we do. Yes.
Thank you very much.
So, are there any other questions about the legislative session and that portion of our agenda?
Mr. Chair, I heard a rumor of the House meeting on Wednesday. So just for what it's worth, I don't know if anything. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I haven't yet reached out to leadership to find out what their plans are. So I'll double check with those guys today. But yeah, thanks for that heads up. Okay. So if we're through with the session update, I did just want to revert back to item three. Now that we do have a quorum, as Margaret pointed out, which is the approval of the May 7th meeting minutes. Do I have a motion on that?
So moved, Lyle Ray.
And seconded by Martin. Is there any discussion? If not, I'll try your minds. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Aye. And any abstentions? Okay, good. So that passes unanimously. Okay, so we'll move on briskly to item five on our agenda, which is the ACIR reports. 5A involves the annual report and work plan, which, if you remember, was drew a little bit of attention at our last meeting. We had referenced as part of our annual report and work plan a discussion of previously completed reports. I think Bruce and it raised some objections because of the one study in particular that was cited initially as a reference point for all of us. That was the Commission on Fiscal Stability and Economic Growth. Bruce was good enough to offer up an amended version of that reference, if you will, and has sent it out to the group. Bruce, I don't know if you wanted to add anything more to that.
Sure. First of all, I'll highlight that Jennifer Berrigan, who raised the concern a month ago, she is out today and was unable to join. And Rick Hart, who is the regular labor representative on the ACIR, is not in this meeting, but I wanted to let everyone here know that I did reach out to them specifically with the proposed change to that certain paragraph that was discussed and has been highlighted, and they are okay with the revised modified language. Basically, what it does is to add a It does list the other entity in the minute in the report, but then highlights that the ACIR is not endorsing the finding, the recommendations, or the methodology of any other group that has worked on this issue. And with that, they were satisfied. And based on the other ACIR member comments at the last meeting, my sense is that everyone else would be satisfied with it. But I did, in circulating it, recommend that any further discussion happen at this meeting, not happen via email, just to follow open meeting requirements.
Right. Thank you, Bruce. Yes. And thanks for your effort to kind of do that redraft of that language with sensitivity to the questions that were raised. Actually, you were the first to actually point out initially that this could be an issue, which I think brought attention to it, which led to some objections and the conversation. So thank you for your diligence on that, because I think it might have gone under the radar had you not been as attentive to that as you were. So with Bruce's report on that, are we in a position, do you think, now, coupled with our discussion at last month's meeting, could we at least put a motion on the table to approve the annual report and work plan as drafted? And then we can have a further discussion on it if we choose.
Yep, I will move, Lyle Ray.
I'll second it, John Alcesser.
Great, thank you.
Lyle, with apologies for being late.
No worries. Opening this up for other discussion, is there any other discussion on that annual report? I'm not seeing any. If folks are comfortable with that report, as revised by, with Bruce's proposed changes, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And any abstentions? Okay, great. So that passes unanimously. Again, thank you, Bruce, for your help with all that. So we have two other ACIR reports under item 5 of our agenda, which are the November session mandate, the sessions mandate, session mandates report, which is due in November, and then our mandates compendium supplement, which is due next January. Bruce, I don't know, do you have anything further to add on that?
I just wanted to add that I will probably leave these on the agenda just as a placeholder for the coming months, but I didn't do that just to create a placeholder. It's also that in the past, there have been various suggestions and comments about handling mandates reporting in a different fashion. So I just wanted to start off by getting it there, and maybe next month I will include links to the current reports. I didn't think of that when I put this agenda together, so that members or other people can look at the reports and say, hey, this would be better if you did this, or do you really need all of that? Whatever, there is an interest in improving those reports, and it's better to start that early rather than late in the preparation.
Great. Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. And I think you're right. I mean, I think we tend to sort of, you know, apropos of our earlier discussion about deadlines, you know, as things get closer, that's when we focus our attention on it. But I think Bruce's points are well taken, that to the extent that we can be looking at these things in advance and making some suggestions as to improvements, we should be doing that now rather than, you know, in October. Jim, did you have a point, a comment?
I have a question for Bruce. Bruce, do you think it would be helpful at this point if you just spent a minute or two going over the proposed changes that you've heard in the last several years, the main changes?
Most of the changes that, or I should back up, a number of changes have been discussed. Any changes where the group decided to make such a change, they've already been incorporated, whether it be long ago getting rid of the minor mandate classification. There was a wholesale revision to the full compendium to make it much more concise. Other things have been discussed. There's nothing that would be changed in these reports. If nothing is raised in the coming months, these reports will look like last year's reports. Maybe what I should do, a better response from me would be to go do a little mining through the old minutes and find what people have offered up in the past as possible changes that never were really fully implemented. And then I'll try to put that together for next meeting so people can consider them. I've already begun reviewing the bills that have been signed, looking for mandates, but it's not a hardship to change now. It, as the speaker said, back if we wait till October, it becomes a bit more of a challenge.
Good. I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, agreed. Thanks, Jim. Okay. So moving on to item 6 on our agenda, this which is the LGF initiative. Item 6A, which involves home rule, is listed on our agenda as home rule, et cetera. I wanted to just report to the group about what, if you remember at our meeting last month, we've been kind of a little bit in fits and starts about the work that ACIR has agreed to take on with regard to clarifying the term and the concept of home rule and putting it in a proper context so that it could be relied upon, I think, by the public and by others for a more accurate depiction of what it really means, as well as a more practical application of it to specific issues that the state's considering. I can report to you, and there are minutes or notes, I should say, of the meeting, the subcommittee meeting that took place on May 25th regarding this. And I'll just summarize those by saying, I think the subcommittee is reporting to the full ACIR that a report should be undertaken and with a very specific idea about how it should be laid out. That it should be, it should start with I think the term that Lyle used, which I think is brilliant. We're not trying to boil the ocean here. Is that the term? Is that the metaphor? The term. Yeah. We're not trying to relitigate and go through every aspect of where home rule came from, and relitigate the whole discussion about what it is and where it came from. But it's really just to summarize the term home rule actually is, and then move on to some more precise examples of issues that are in fact coming up right now, where perhaps we're seeing the term misapplied or misused, or misunderstood anyway, as well as other points where it could be clarified with regard to, let's say, financial obligations of a town or the role of the Board of Education, which I think Bob had pointed out at the subcommittee meeting. The idea of this study would be to precisely summarize what home rule really means, and then move on to more specific examples for application purposes. I can tell you that both the majority leader in the House and the House chair of Planning and Development have both told me that they would really welcome that that report from ACIR to help in their own discussions legislatively. But also it would be used, I think, and I think the subcommittee agreed with this, that it would then be, that baseline could then be used to inform other LGF initiatives that we may want to propose for the 2022 legislative session going forward. The last thing I'll report is that there was a consensus, I think, on accessing expertise from others to help the subcommittee continue that work. Specifically, a couple of the institutes that exist within UConn and Central who may be interested in helping us move on the subject, as well as outside counsel with expertise on the subject matter, who could also give us a little bit more of the legal color and flavor of that. I had in my mind, and I'll full disclosure, I had in my mind the one guy that I know is like the state expert legally on home rule issues, and that he happens to be joining us now, attorney Steve Mednick, who advises many municipalities around the state on charter revision and on this question of what their jurisdiction is and what the legal limits and statutory limits are for their own authority. And it's something he's been studying and working on for many, many years. And I've known Steve for a long time. So, and I talked to Steve and, he's graciously agreed to help out at least in that conversation initially. Doing so gratis, I should mention currently, but you know, if there are any other kinds of, I don't know, Bruce and Martin, if there are any resources that OPM otherwise had, financial or otherwise, that might also be able to help us out in terms of our efforts to do this, that I'd appreciate your weighing in on that. But that's the, that would be my summary of the subcommittee meeting and what we discussed there with regard to the home rule study. I don't know if anyone else has any additional comments on that. Margaret?
Yeah, I would love, you know, I'm from way back an ACIR member, and I would, again, as a volunteer kind of thing, I have a PhD and all that kind of stuff, and I know, you know, a lot of folks around, and I'm very interested in the topic. So if you need my help, I'm available online only. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, be careful what you volunteer for.
Online only. I have a PhD, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I'm a city planner. So, and whatever, yeah, I can do, yeah, to help.
Absolutely.
I could be a cheerleader, public relations agent, whatever.
Great. Terrific. Thank you for that. John?
Yeah. Thank you. And I think it's great that Steve's agreed to do that. That'll really help us out a lot, and Margaret as well. And I think you captured what the consensus was of the subcommittee. And I just wanted to add that just, you know, in the last few days, watching the legislature and the bill we talked about earlier, 6448, it was a short debate, but this issue was mentioned two or three times, maybe four, that came up. And and reading through, which I don't know why I did, but House Bill 6107, the zoning reform piece, it is scattered throughout there. And so we absolutely need to do this work, and the approach suggested by Lyle and yourself, I think, is the correct one. So I'm ready to get going on it.
Yeah, thank you. Francis?
Yes, thanks, Brendan. It's not exactly clear to me what the purpose of this work is, because is it to provide some clarity about the legal status of home rule, or to get into more political science aspects of how government should be structured across various levels, for instance, the subsidiarity principle? Is it a policy analysis about where the most efficient place to house various functions is? There's a big constellation of related things here, and there's a lot we could be biting off, and I want to make sure you take the right bite.
Sure, that's a good question. I would say that it's not intended to be a full public policy analysis of what should be, but rather is a touchstone for what is. How's that? The idea that I think the observations of ACI members over the course of the last few months has been that the term itself has been appropriated by different issues and by different folks for and against a particular issue. And I think the observation has been, in some cases, that it's been misapplied. And we need to, I think the group has felt that it's ACIR's role to kind of do a reset on this, to make sure folks are accurately describing what home rule really is, and not misapplying or misusing that term out of just ignorance of what the law really is. And so that was the reason and the impetus for ACIR weighing in on this. Again, not with the intent of trying to prescribe what should be, but rather helping folks kind of understand that maybe when they think of home rule as giving them, I'm just making this up, but, you know, if they appropriate the term home rule as a basis for why they should be able to do X, Y, or Z, you know, maybe there needs to be a touchstone there that says, well, you know, that's not really what home rule is about. Let's more accurately describe it before people sort of broadly misuse the term for their own purposes. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, can I add something to that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Lyle.
Yeah. To recast my recollection of the committee meeting, and this is going to involve John Filchak too, my understanding, we came away with two parts. One is to do a summary of home rule and what it means, not to sort of relitigate the whole Dillon rule, you know, 500 pages of constitutional argument, but sort of say, here's what it is, here's what the law is, and be very clear about that in a relatively short piece. Part two, and this is where John made a good suggestion of applying principles of home rule and other to the local government of the future themes. In other words, what are we needing to do? So if we need to do more shared services, what does that mean? In other words, our title is Intergovernmental Relations. This is absolutely core to it. So a relatively short brief on the whole issue of home rule and what it really means and so forth. And that's been, Bruce has been kind enough to send out papers that have got, you know, really good background material on that. Not much has changed. But part two, and John, maybe you want to describe maybe better than I just attempted to do, you know, the idea of application of some of this to the some of the key themes. And that goes back to the point of not trying to boil the ocean, but so identify half a dozen areas where we might move forward and how the conversation might go.
John, did you want to follow up from
that? Yeah, I think, you know, that's what, you know, I think we were trying to get it in the context of the Local Government of the Future initiative and build off of what we were trying to put in place this session. And this question of what is home rule and what home rule is not, I think needs to, in order for us to go forward, needs to be clarified, and then allows us to then explore some subject areas going forward in a very specific way. But rather than, as Lyle said, the you know, the 1987 report, which kind of was all the way back in time, we're not looking to redo that report, but to concisely clarify the issue and then identify a few going forward. So I think that's where we're trying to do, and so that we can move beyond. And I think what you laid out there too, Brendan, the way it's been misappropriated and used, and I don't know all the time it's intentional. In fact, I think most of the time it's not intentional, that folks really believe that we're a home rule state and we have all this and all the things that may or may not go with it. So it's going to be difficult to move forward until we get that clarity, so that we're all on the same page. And there's a high degree of politics that have entered into it too, because it's an attractive issue, you know, the rights of towns, et cetera, et cetera. So it'll be an interesting discussion.
Yeah, thanks,
John. I would just to follow up with my comment. I think it's a very worthwhile endeavor, but I do think that reasonable people can differ on how best to structure government. And sometimes I believe that home rule may be used as a synonym for local control. And so I think it's important that we keep those two things separate.
Right. Agreed. Yeah. I agree with you, Francis. And I think that's the point of this study, frankly, to keep these things in their appropriate lanes so that that's an example of how it can be misappropriated by blurring distinctions that you just described. So Rick and then John.
Thanks, Brendan. I'll do this quickly, but I really think this is important too. And as I've said in other meetings, one of the most important things ACIR can do for the state and for our cities and towns. I think it's also, based on this conversation, more and more important to me, at least, that we frame this work in just the right way. I don't know if some of you have seen the reporting from other states around the country where we've become so divisive in our public discussion on almost every issue that matters, that this question of state-local relationship in some red states is where larger metropolitan areas are their ability to act on things that matter to them is being restricted by state legislatures and state administrations. And so if we do this right and talk about how important this is, I think people on both sides of the issue might understand better why we're doing a real service for people, no matter what their political point of view may be on some of these issues, that all we're trying to do is, and I won't try to repeat the whole thing, but what Lyle described and what you described, to allow us all to have an informed, level-headed discussion on these things that matter so much. Thanks.
Yeah, agreed. Thanks, Rick. John?
Just two quick points. One, as part of this educational piece, and we're talking about what home rule is, and then point to statutes that authorize other specific duties or responsibilities that are allowable. And my favorite statute that I've forgotten the number of it, I used to have it memorized, that municipalities can do collectively that which they're entitled to do individually. And nobody knows that. And they always go through a big, to-do about, well, we can't share this and we can't do that. It's like, no, there's a statute that says you can do that. So the other part of the government of the future is to let people know that there are state statutes that actually give towns authority to do much more than they think they can. So that's the other side of this home rule, is that the state has empowered. And then I would also offer that if, and this may go beyond the scope and get down that rabbit hole I think Francis is concerned about, of do we have other suggestions of changes in state laws that would facilitate the government of the future? Because without enabling legislation, the towns really can't do that. And specifically looking at some modest fee type things that some people argue we can do and some don't, like charging for fire inspections. It's not specifically enabled, I don't believe, in the state statutes, but a lot of towns do it. But would there be some broad language that would allow some authorization with caps and other processes and public hearings and all those things to enable towns to recoup mandated state services that the towns are providing?
Right. Right.
Like checking for fire detectors in apartments.
Thank you. Yeah, right, right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And that would be, an area, and I think we'd be open. I think the premise would be we'd open this up to a number of those kinds of more specific discussions that need to happen. You know, what's possible, what isn't. I know Lon had made the point, too, at the subcommittee about, the same application with regard to the relationship between boards of ed and what's possible and what isn't under statute. So these are all key subject areas that I think would be the real, as Lyle pointed out, would really be the guts of the report beyond just making general statements about what the law really is, but then having a practical application to it. So, Jim.
I just wanted to point out the statute that John was referencing about what one town may do, other towns may do together, was an ACIR initiative from way back when.
You got big thumbs up for Margaret on that one.
Yeah.
And it's important that we follow up on that initiative that you guys wisely did in the past, because there are organizations that dispute that.
For example, the state police say, oh no, two towns can't have a shared police department. That's the jurisdiction of state police. And I totally disagree with that. Because I think
I agree. I agree with you, John.
But the state police will always say, oh no, no, those are resident trooper towns and you can't provide police services to a resident trooper town because that's illegal.
Right. Yeah. That's been a problem.
Yeah. Margaret, did you want to weigh in on that?
Yes. A long time ago, I think in the 70s or whatever it was, Weston changed their charter so that they could have their own. They were a state trooper's town and they changed. I don't know if that's still possible.
Yeah, that's possible. But we've been and I'll take up too much time.
Never mind.
But we're a small police department and we're surrounded by resident trooper towns that have like one resident trooper and no coverage after midnight. And they've approached us and said, hey, can you provide coverage? And the cost of resident troopers has skyrocketed. And they're like even putting on the cost of body camera storage on the towns. So we could provide service at 70% of what a state police officer is. But the state police union in particular says, no, you can't legally do that.
Well, maybe that's also an opportunity for the ERPIP 2.0 as well, John. Just putting that out. But in any case, yes, right. So that's a good example of.
But Mr. Chair, if I could just add one more thing, not to belabor this, but I think going forward, if we want to do the local government of the future, what intergovernmental tasks might need to be changed? And this goes back to John's point and Francis. I think that would be a list that we need to refine. In other words, you can't do 5,000 things, whether you mentioned license fees and other kinds of things. I think we could be handling some of those things generically in terms of, and then many states say you can charge anything for a license fee if you can demonstrate that you're recovering costs. In other words, some states say you can't make a profit, but you can fully recover costs, and they have various accounting rules. But in other words, I think we could cover some of those things as themes, but I think part of it would be, you know, part one, looking over what needs to be restated on the home rule reality in terms of the 1987 paper and earlier. And then looking at the local government of the future themes that John had talked about at our committee meeting and identifying, you know, no more than half a dozen major initiatives. Because I think to Rick's point, you know, this is sort of our core business. You know, that's sort of what we do. But again, I think it has to be a manageable number so that we don't drown. And it might have specific legislative implications, but, you know, we don't want to drown ourselves in a, you know, remake of, you know, state law on local government. We can't do that.
Right. Agreed. Okay, good. So that's where we stand. I think if it's fair, obviously, you know, ACIR has already agreed to move forward on this initiative. But I think what we'll do is we'll plan to have the subcommittee meet on our appointed meeting day, which would be Tuesday the 22nd at 10:30 a.m. and we'll get notices out to folks, but that will begin our work in earnest on putting this together if everyone's in agreement. And obviously anyone who's interested in participating is welcome to join us, including Steve and Margaret, and as well as other members of the commission. With regard to item 6B, which is improving the state-local relationship, Bruce, help me on this one. I wasn't quite sure what we wanted to cover with that particular agenda item.
I was trying to do two things at one time. So
don't do that. That's
I was looking at the agenda, and then I had to scroll over three screens to return to get myself on the meeting. Basically, this has been a kind of a side topic of the subcommittee meetings, and it's somewhat related to what you've been discussing. One of the issues that's been raised is how the UConn Institute of Public Service has gone dormant, and there has been some discussion of the fact that they are really supposed to maintain such a thing. So there's been a side discussion of main of creating those contacts to get those outside resources, which is what you had mentioned earlier in the discussion of the home rule, as far as the UConn Public Policy Department, the CCSU Institute of whatever they call it, that deals with these same kind of issues. So I don't know that this other thing really needs to be addressed. It's just part of what the LGF is dealing with, trying right. to get those resources.
Thanks for that reminder. Right.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
And well, yeah, I was going to go to you, Lyle, too, because
yep. I just wanted to add, Bruce makes a good point. First, the bad news, we are getting a turnover in the UConn president again. People were making approaches to the president on the topic of a public policy institute as a responsibility of the land-grant university, which is a pretty common, you know, part of the terrain for a land-grant university like UConn, and we're getting a new president. So that's the bad news. The good news is, and this goes to you, Brendan, but, you know, in relationship with the governor and others, for the an incoming new president of UConn to sort of try and get that message in early, because Governor Lamont sat on the Institute for Municipal Research at CCSU when it was not just confined to police stops and a few other things, but it had a broader regional mission that would complement ours. But so I guess my plea here for folks is, for those that have the connections to the governor's office, and I believe Paul Mounds is the liaison to the UConn board, there's various places to go to try and approach the whoever the incoming president of UConn is. We have an interim one, but I think that's, I wouldn't advise that. But for the new president is to try and get our oar in the water on the land-grant university's responsibility to have a public policy center. We shouldn't really make, you know, making it that hard. So my two cents.
Yeah, thanks for that. John?
I think, the prospect of as much as I would like to see, of getting the Institute of Public Service reincarnated at UConn is probably more than a long shot. But perhaps we should pursue it. One avenue that came to mind since the last meeting that some land-grant universities take on, which is similar to what the Institute of Public Service did, is right through their cooperative extension system, which we have in place at the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. And don't be thrown by the words agriculture and natural resources. They do a great deal of community applied research. And that may be an avenue to approach, since they are funded, to approach the dean if there's a place there for the type of work that the Institute used to do. Since it's in place, it's funded, both federally and state, maybe another avenue to approach. And I'm happy, since I used to do that in my old job, to try to open some doors there. But if we wanted to have entree into UConn, that may be another another way to do that.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. There's also the board, the UConn board as well. So there
yep.
are folks that we yep. can talk to at that point, at that level too.
But I just wanted to flag. The opportunity with a turnover in president. I don't disagree with John's suggestion at all. In many, many states, the agricultural extension is an extremely robust institution that, you know, has major batting weight and also does a lot of policy research in a lot of states. So I think it's a perfectly reasonable option to explore in addition, for sure.
Yeah, thank you. Jim, do you have a comment?
Yes, question, Brandon. Didn't someone mention a few months ago that the Institute actually was a matter of legislation, that had been established and was supposed to be a functioning institution? And could we research that legislation and find out what it actually says?
I think I'll defer, obviously, to Lyle and to John, who are much more knowledgeable about this than I. But I think their point, I think you're remembering that correctly. And I think what they were pointing out was that this is one of the initial charges of any land grant university. So it's actually federally established as a requirement, if I understand it correctly. If you're going to establish a land grant university in your state, these are some of the provisions that you must offer in order to have that designation. I don't know, Lyle, or John, do you mind?
Sure.
Go ahead, Lyle.
Well, I can recite the Morrill Act. That would be interesting. Well, it was 1864, even before my time. But the point is that these were established by President Lincoln. I remember him well. As agricultural and mechanical arts institutions, but they were basically to advance the economy and the agricultural productivity of the country. And over time, a number of additional features have been added to that. But I'm saying one of the common features of land grant institutions is to be a valuable policy resource for state government and the state as a whole to advise. And again, they are somewhat limited in terms of getting into extremely radioactive, politically charged issues, but they often do provide good advice on, you know, how should you pay for infrastructure, or what, that may be not a good example. So that's where it came from. And many, many states use, and again, John's point is well taken, the agricultural extension in many states is a very muscular, large operation that everybody knows. Every county has a county agricultural extension agent, and you know them very well. So they have a lot of influence. But I think there's a lot of different ways to go. But I think going back to the IMRP, this goes back to when CCSU had a lot of sort of former legislators in various chairs. You know, Don, Alzheimer here, former mayor of New Britain.
DeFranzo.
DeFranzo, thank you. I need my memory aid here. But there were a whole series of people who were relatively connected. And I think there were legislative actions related to the IMRP, which I don't recall. But that time, they were a lot of relatively former heavyweight legislative folks over there, as you might recall, Brendan, Don DeFranzo, and several others in appointed.
Tony terms. Milano, formerly of OPM.
That was who I was thinking of, Tony Milano, Don DeFranzo, and others. So I recall, and at that time, now Governor Lamont was on it, as I was, and we were not focused. This is a decade ago. We were not focused on what they're focused on now, but it was a much broader issue of how do we make regions work better? How do we have help municipalities get more efficient? That's sort of what it was. That was what we were talking about at CCSU 10 years ago. So, but I believe, and again, we can try and rustle up some of the history on this, is that there was legislative action and funding for some of the chairs, endowed chairs at CCSU related to this.
Still one.
I think it's worth the outreach. And given I have a bit of knowledge in that my wife is an emeritus faculty member from the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Cooperative Extension. And so I have
there's a connection.
Give it in. Yep.
I can make some connections, and I'm happy to do so.
Great. Margaret?
Yes, I just want to, I think Rick Porth was a speaker at an ACIR symposium on the very same subject, and I'm sure he's got some good ideas and connections. Not that I'm offering you up. Okay. I'm not volunteering.
Thanks, Margaret. I'm happy to help out if I can. Yeah. It's important.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Because this is the kind of resource that we need to, you know, in terms of when we go back to our previous discussion about the study for, home rule study, you know, this type of an institute would help, would be invaluable, I think, for providing some guidance on this. So thank you for that. I wanted to now move on to item 7 of our agenda on under old business, but to hand it over to Lyle with regard to our an update on our policy studies with UGA.
Yep, we have policy studies, and the question I think is which one you might want to do next for a webinar. John was a mentor on the revenue diversification study. We have an e-government study, and we have one on shared services that took a fairly broad view, including some of the look into even the United Kingdom's work. So those are the three studies. I don't know, John, if you want to make a commercial on the revenue diversification study, but my suggestion or request here is, you know, pick one and then think about a fall launch of a webinar on one of those three if you if you're interested. You're on mute, John.
It's sitting on the corner of my desk here somewhere. But
probably not the only thing on the corner of your desk.
No, it's been a busy earmarks took a lot of time. So I think we could reach out to see whether the revenue diversification is ready for presentation. I think that would be the first step before we try to schedule.
Yep. But is there a sense of members in terms of what you might find most timely or interesting? Revenue diversification is one. Accelerating web-based and e-government, which the governor's done some efforts on recently with Commissioner Gavall, and also the shared services one, which is broader, but looks at the whole issue of, you know, accelerating shared services. Those are the three. And again, to John's point, we can confirm with the authors of the three studies, you know, one from UGA and two from UConn, you know, if they're ready for prime time. But is there a preference among members in terms of which of those three topics might be of interest first in terms of a fall launch?
Lyle, can I also just ask a question before your question is answered? Is there a limited availability of the authors of the study in terms of, you know, if they're moving on or graduating? You know, this is primarily being done by students, but
yes,
with mentorship by professors. But are some of those folks moving on, and should that maybe put one in front of another if we know that the student who did the study is going to be moving on?
So the revenue diversification, the person was actually on the staff of the college, so I think they're still there. So, but we should check. We could check with Elka and find out.
Yeah, we could start with your preferences, but to your point, the webinar that you were helping to host, that student had already moved on, but was willing to come back and do it. So if you had a, you know, preference here, we could then sort of, to John's point, you know, check with them and see what's doable. I did not check in advance to see what's doable. Basically, I wanted to hear what the preferences were, and then we'll sort of have to juggle that with your point, which is, you know, who's still available. But I believe the UConn individual is available, and we could check with our UGA person. But it was just a matter of seeing what preferences might have emerged from the group here.
Yeah, Rick, did you have a thought?
Just a quick comment. You all know that CCM's been working on something we hope to roll out in the coming weeks or over the summer related to this. And some of you are familiar with the work that the Collins Center at UMass has been doing on our behalf with regard to shared services. But I'll just say this, that and also university, Georgia State University is working on a piece of our report related to revenue diversification. I think it's all good. I think we can, it's complementary to the work that's already been undertaken through ACIR. And my suggestion or thought is that in our report, a lot of the shared services work is framed as e-government, multi-town, when through the regions when it's possible.
Uh-huh.
And I think because the governor and DAS has made it such a priority with regard to state government, it could be something where we could ride that wave and convince the powers that be in the state government that they should invest also in more e-government solutions that allow for multi-town responses and shared services that could be done through COGS and or RESCs even potentially
using an RPIP grant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know.
Or the new formula.
What
for
I'm saying
ours.
Is, I think we could leverage each other's work and try to really create some broad support for that. I think.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's a great reminder, Rick. I forgot about it. I sit on that and I forgot about it. So Alzheimer's here.
Well, it depends on where your brains are, Lyle, if you're sitting on it. So.
Yeah, there you go. We'll leave that aside.
Sorry.
But the suggestion might be to, wait for the CCM rollout and see what would be complementary. I'm happy because, Rick, for my involvement with that, and John could comment too, but I think the CCM report covers all three reports we're talking about here in some way, every single one of them. So it might make a lot of sense to see what CCM has and roll that out and then see where we most fit in afterwards. That would be, again, I don't think there's any harm done on that. I think, but again, the fact that John, I don't know if you agree, but I think the CCM report covers all three bases.
Yeah, and I did share that information with the intern, the early stages of it. I haven't seen the most recent because it kind of got lost in COVID, but I think, and Rick, you probably know better than I, I know they're ready to re-gear that up, but I don't know their time frame.
John, I can't answer that right now. I hope it's over the summer.
Okay.
And I meant what I said. I really do believe that the work you've helped to do, you and Lyle and the researchers, could absolutely be complementary to what we're trying to do, and that we could support each other and leverage each other's work.
Yep. I would say, why don't we shoot for Lyle? Why don't we shoot for the fall for the revenue diversification, and then follow that up with the shared services, and CCM may fit both, and I think if we kind of somehow bookend them, I think that would be really helpful.
Yep. Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense, Mr. Chair. But I think, Rick, to the extent that, whenever you do find out what the time frame is, I think it would be good to follow up. I guess have the CCM report kick it off, and then we can follow up with, as John said, the revenue diversification and shared services, which I guess we could almost fold the two in. By the way, the e-government and shared services is done by the same student, so we could actually cheat and blend those together. Which would make some sense. But I think it would be great to sort of start with the CCM kickoff, and then we would follow through as John has suggested.
Hey, Lyle, I appreciate you saying that. We all of us have talked about PSAPs and public works contracting and other big ticket items with regard to shared services. I honestly think, and if anyone disagrees, please say so, that in terms of timing, again, if we could frame our shared services recommendations, especially at the outset around e-government, I think we'd have a better chance of winning support from our state partners too in moving towards important shared services. And we'd be leveraging the work of the COGS and potentially the RESCs as well.
Yep. Works for me.
Software is always cheaper when a whole bunch of people are together.
Yep.
Amen. Amen. Okay. Thanks. Thanks all for that. And thanks, Lyle, for helping to clarify that.
Great. Helpful.
With Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
Okay. So under new business, we have 2022 legislative session planning. We've discussed that already a little bit, but we've got some work to do at the subcommittee level with the LGF subcommittee, but also just what we just talked about in terms of the studies and that are being done in the coordination with CCM. So that all those will help inform and feed into a 2022 legislative agenda, which seems like a long time from now, but it needs to be started now. And finalized in the fall, so we can move forward in the towards the 22 agenda. Are there any other comments about that we need to discuss? I appreciate Bruce putting that on the agenda because, again, it's a reminder of what needs to happen and keeping us focused. If not, are there any other discussion topics that folks want to raise for today's meeting?
Nope.
Just one quick informational item. Bill Yule, who's the head of the 911 commission, has retired.
Ah.
So we're seeing the start of that wave.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Thank you, John. And I'll throw this open too for any public comment that folks might want to offer, non-ACIR members. We generally open it up to other folks, even if they're not members, but are there any other public comments that folks might want to make? Bob?
And just quickly, as I try to digest the legislative session and what might happen in special, there's been discussion about ACIR taking up the subject of what or how one might have hybrid town meetings and still allow votes, being able to qualify voters for town meeting. Has anyone had any reach out to you on that?
Not to me personally. And I know that obviously that was the issue that tanked the governor's bill, which included our provisions for the RPIP 2.0. And we did discuss that earlier in the meeting with Martin about what the governor's future plans are with regard to 6448. But it's a really interesting question that you're raising, though, which is, if there is heartburn on the part of many with regard to that provision of 6448 involving those hybrid meetings, maybe I hate to say this because it usually has other meanings, but maybe that is, in an effort to kind of get 6448 moving, maybe that is a study subject that ACIR can participate in. Obviously, it's not going to be short term, but we can queue it up and have some discussions about it and be helpful with it towards the 22 session if that becomes necessary.
Particularly, as we discussed previously, for local governments of the future, certainly having greater availability for participation in town meetings or other meetings is important. And so if we do take that up, I'd be happy to do some work on that. We have had probably four meetings now, hybrid town meetings, and it's worked well. And I think it's something that we should, as an organization, ACIR, try to move forward with.
Boy, Bob, that's a great point.
We can.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point, because, for anybody who was watching the debate on the floor, but also I got ambushed at the committee public hearing on this topic, even though I wasn't testifying on this particular provision. I think the heartburn that was expressed about the bill and about the prospect of hybrid meetings was the unfunded state mandate aspect of it and the potential cost to the towns to facilitate that kind of a meeting. That's where the opposition came from, and that's where folks were uncomfortable. And so if there's a role that we can play in helping to facilitate a solution to that, that's obviously right in our wheelhouse.
I think that would be good.
So the reality was, it was all the FOIA requirements that were tacked on that don't exist if you have a live meeting. So they were adding really expensive administrative burdens that you have to have technology for all these meetings. I mean, I'm sorry, do I need to have a tech person show up at a cemetery commission meeting? I mean, I don't think there's an understanding that, like, our town has, over 35 boards and commissions. At some nights we have four meetings in the town hall. There's no way we could tech staff those things and then store those videotapes for, forever. I mean, so it was overreach, and that's why it got killed. It's like,
well, But that was addressed in the bill. You know, in the bill that was before him that didn't make it, that concern was addressed.
I think there are many compromises made. My comment is, and then I appreciate John's comment on the number of boards and commissions, but my comment was more specifically to the town meeting,
right,
which all of our statutory municipalities have as part of their legislative body. And so having a method or means or a guidance on how to identify people to be eligible voters at town meeting, I thought is something that we could do and add to that debate and still allow us going forward. My fear is that if we don't solve the issue, we go back to the 18th century method of having town meetings only when people are available, or as we have an ordinance that actually said that you couldn't have town meetings after candlelight. So we shouldn't be doing that. We're in the 21st century. We should have methods and means for people to participate.
Yeah, let me offer that up. As I talk to leadership about implementers and special session topics, obviously Martin and OPM, the governor's office, are working on this as well. But on behalf of ACIR, as I pitch those provisions that hopefully we can include in an implementer that we've already voted on and are recommending, that may be the other offer that we could make to help facilitate the discussion to a resolution if they can't get to a resolution on the remaining part of the bill. Margaret, sure.
Another possible workaround kind of thing could be to say all those elected boards and commissions should be recorded as opposed to the dog catcher's special meeting or whatever, and perhaps make it voluntary so that they don't feel that someone's shoving a mandate down your throat. That's just my thought.
Yeah. Well, we're not there yet. We don't really know quite what the discussions have been internally about what's good and what's bad. But presumably we could dive into that if we offer that up. John?
I think if you recall during the debate in the House, a concern was raised that ACIR was directed to do a study or an evaluation of this process in the preceding ones. And it was saying it was like the cart before the horse, that you're doing the study after the fact. And perhaps if it's reversed, that we do what Bob is suggesting, I guess another review of that language and adjustments for looking at the 22 session, unless it's going to, there's some miraculous way it's going to pass. You could almost flip the bill, if you will, because there was a lot of compromises made in terms of hybrid meetings, very much along the lines that's being discussed of issues. But we do the study over the interim and then make some recommendations for the 22 session as to how that would properly work for the state.
Yeah. I will certainly offer that up on behalf of ACIR as part of this discussion. So it's a great suggestion, Bob. And I think, as been mentioned, we're the group to do that. That's in our wheelhouse. So, okay. Thanks for that. Any other discussion topics or comments? If not, our next subcommittee meeting would be June 22nd. Again, as I mentioned, that's a Tuesday at 10:30 a.m. And then our next full ACIR meeting will actually be not the first Friday of July because of the holiday, but on July 9th at 10:30, which is the second Friday of the month. And sounds like we've got a lot of work to do between now and then. So, If everyone is comfortable.
Motion to adjourn?
Yes, a motion to adjourn from Lyle, second by Sam Gold. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Great. Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for your participation this month. We got a lot of work done, and we got a lot of work to do. So stay tuned, but have a good weekend in the meantime.
Thanks, everybody.